Again, I will extend my welcome to this 20th anniversary celebration of the NINR. What is very clear is that we are also celebrating the impact of 20 years of research training and research funding on the healthcare of America and beyond, as we also learned this afternoon. And as I prepared to moderate this panel and looked at the CVs, I became very much aware of how we need to celebrate the caliber and excellence of the scientists who are doing this work and will, at least in my panel, be presenting this afternoon on symptom management. I'm not going to go in much detail on their credentials for talking with you and sharing their research because it's in the booklet in terms of their bios, but our first presenter will be Kai Moore, and Kai is a professor at the College of Nursing, University of Arizona, and has a long history of funding beginning as oncology nursing, and also the NINR, of course, and has been able to leverage her grasp of research funding and research training into a T32 and a P20 as well. Kai.
Thank you. Thank you for hanging around after cookies for the last session. And it's a pleasure for me to be here and share this research. I have done most of my work, as Donna has said, in the area of childhood leukemia. And I'd like to share with you some of the findings from our MATH intervention grant that was funded by the National Institute for Nursing Research and also co-funded by the National Cancer Institute. Just as a little bit of background for you, if you're not familiar with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, it is the most common pediatric tumor. And as you heard from Dr. Hines this morning, cancer in children remains the leading cause of death under the age of 19. However, we also have good news, and that is that improved survival has really been dramatic in some pediatric tumors, and acute lymphoblastic leukemia is one of them. There are approximately 2,800 new cases of ALL each year, once uniformly fatal. Now, five-year disease-free survival approaches 85%. And this slide just summarizes for you from 1960 to the most current statistics of 2000, five-year disease-free survival. And as many of you know, once you reach that five-year mark, the probability of disease recurrence or death from disease is far less than accidents or other things. So it's a good news story, and it's happened for several reasons. One, of course, is understanding that leukemia is a biologically heterogeneous disease, and you can tailor therapy by risk for relapse for children who have low-risk, standard, or high-risk disease. It was also recognized, probably right around the 1960s, that the central nervous system, I have two things to do at one time, that's a little challenging. The central nervous system is a sanctuary site in pediatric leukemia, and what that means is at the time of diagnosis, rarely will the child be positive for leukemia in spinal fluid, and that's part of the diagnostic workup. However, without direct treatment of the brain, 80% of children would relapse in the central nervous system and then subsequently die from a bone marrow relapse. So the addition of CNS treatment to leukemia protocols dramatically reduced that relapse rate to less than 10%. So CNS treatment is essential for long-term survival from childhood leukemia. However, it does come with a price. And that is the adverse effects of treating a developing nervous system with chemotherapeutic drugs, previously radiation. Most treatment protocols now are limited to chemotherapy unless a child has very high-risk disease or, of course, brain tumors. So across studies, there are findings that validate CNS treatment-related declines in areas such as general intelligence, academic abilities, visual motor skills, and attention. And this is collective data from several studies from myself and a colleague, Chris Kamik, a group of 87 children with ALL. And these children only received intrathecal chemotherapy methotrexate, as well as high-dose systemic methotrexate that crosses the blood-brain barrier. And this is baseline. Granted, you know we can't get baseline evaluations before diagnosis, but we try to do our baseline evaluations as shortly after diagnosis as we can. This is now following children from 2 years, and actually we have data 3 years from ALL diagnosis. The purple is math abilities, the green is visual motor, the blue is verbal fluency, and lastly, reading, which is an area that sometimes generally seems to be preserved. But what I want to point out is we're talking about a whole standard deviation decline in academic math, a significant decline in visual motor skills and verbal fluency. And one of the interesting things about this, and if I was talking with a parent group, it's just, these are almost like a new notch group. They have significant declines in their academic abilities, but they're not, haven't declined enough that they get the red flag of the schools that they are, quote, in need of special ed and oftentimes fall through the cracks. And so this is a vignette that I, by the way, I added this. It's not in your handout. But I have been getting more and more emails like this one, and this came from a neuropsychologist of a child who would have been on her study, but her family relocated to Colorado. And so there wasn't the availability of an intervention for her. But it's, I think, telling of what families experience. This is a 7-year-old girl. She's now 2 years post-treatment for ALL, or acute lymphoblastic leukemia. She's having difficulty with early learning, especially math. She shows minimal progression of her math skills, especially the basic mechanics of computation. Verbal skills better than visual motor skills. By the way, visual motor skills highly correlated with analytic abilities. And she has problems with cognitive processing speed. From a behavioral perspective, she was having some anxieties and difficulty with emotional regulation. But I want to draw your attention to the experience that the mother's having. Mother is incredibly resourceful, but she's reached the maximum of her abilities to tutor. Mom, dad, and the sibling have strong visual, spatial, and math skills, sort of like engineering type, as the neuropsychologist described, making it all the more difficult for them to understand what their daughter's going through and how they can help her. So our intervention is designed to prevent those kinds of problems. And I'd like to share with you some of the results of our study, both the cognitive, academic, and a little bit about some of the mechanisms of injury. This is our math intervention room. We try to create an environment that looks exciting. These are actually math balls, and you can, part of our intervention is to develop visual motor skills. And of course, they're different for different skill levels, but the child catches the ball and has to solve the problem. The goals were to determine if a math intervention could prevent declines in academic math scores in children with ALL, and secondly, to try to understand the mechanisms of chemotherapy-induced injury to the brain. Our philosophy or underlying perspective is that learning occurs not as students take in mathematical knowledge, but try to create a meaning for them. And what that means is we took a very multimodal approach to developing a math intervention. I was blessed by working with Cynthia Anhalt, who's a co-investigator and her PhD is in math curriculum. And I have to give her credit and acknowledge her expertise in developing our intervention, which was 40 to 50 hours. I heard someone talk about a 20-minute intervention this morning. 40 to 50 hours was a lot. And we did that because our pilot data suggested in order to have a robust effect, we really needed to work with patients or children that much. And we used a multimodal approach to helping children explore math. And actually, my goal was to optimize their math abilities before they began receiving CNS treatment that I knew was going to deteriorate in that area. So methods, for example, we use manipulatives, virtual and concrete manipulatives, pictorial and symbolic ways of understanding analytic abilities or analytic problems, symbolic algorithms, and even talking about what math means. I don't know if any of you have been, there's really fun manipulatives. These are base 10 blocks, where this is teaching a child 10 single units is equal to 110, and that gets to 100. And while that looks obvious to us, it's a great way to help children understand in a visual, motor, tactile sense, rather than just knowing that 10 times 10 is 100. Results. Well, we have completed data on 57 children. We are still finishing up with a little bit of our sample. But 24 children have completed the intervention, and actually 1 year post-intervention data, and 33 children in our standard care group. And I am here to tell you that I'm so pleased that we had positive effects. This is math abilities. This is calculation. This is standard score points. This is baseline, again, diagnosis. We started our intervention shortly after year one, and hopefully our next grant, which is under review, we have learned we can start earlier because, as you can see, we're already starting to get a decline. But we had a significant positive effect in our intervention group in not only preventing declines, but improving performance while the control group declined. This is applied problems. It's another math measure. And again, we had highly significant findings. I was very pleased to see that attention, which is an area that has repeatedly been found in the literature to be problematic, we also had a significant robust effect on attention, and we prevented some of the decline in visual motor abilities. So, in summary, our math intervention, we were successful in preventing declines in math abilities. In fact, we had a significant gain in mean math scores after 40 to 50 hours of intervention. We not only improved math abilities, but we improved performance on standardized measures of attention and minimized declines in visual motor skills. We now have evidence that those effects were sustained at least 12 months after the end of our intervention. So, a little bit about what's going on in the central nervous system. And mind you, we're using a behavioral intervention with the goal of optimizing the functions that the child has, recognizing that drugs like methotrexate, commonly used for ALL treatment, has a biologic effect in damaging the central nervous system. And the way methotrexate works as an anti-leukemic drug is it blocks an enzyme known as dihydrofolate reductase, which is critical for purine and pyrimidine synthesis, and that's how it works in preventing lymphoblastic cells from dividing. However, it also minimizes protein synthesis then, and there has been some evidence to show in animal models that when treated with methotrexate, antioxidant enzymes are depleted. So we looked at increased oxidation of lipids and phospholipids and free fatty acids, and we did that because phospholipids, a key component of the cell membrane, is highly vulnerable to oxidative damage, and the free fatty acid undergoes beta oxidation, which is a known mechanism of oxidative injury. So this is just to depict a nice normal phospholipid membrane, and what we see with the fatty acids is we get kinks in the membrane and we lose that nice linear arrangement. So I'm going to quickly go through the methods, but one of the unfortunate things for children with leukemia is in addition to getting an LP at the time of diagnosis, they get repeated lumbar punctures throughout therapy in order to deliver intrathecal methotrexate. They approximately 20 to 24 intrathecal therapies. So we are able to get 1 to 2 mL of CSF during those LPs. And we were looking specifically for oxidation of the phospholipid phosphatidylcholine and fatty acid unsaturation. And we did that on the PC or phosphatidylcholine by reading at two different wavelengths. One reads for oxidized and one reads for unoxidized PC, and that way we could get a ratio. And then we used gas chromatography to measure fatty acid monounsaturation. This is, we have complete data on 49 children, low standard and high risk. Low risk means that they had the best outcome, best probability of survival, least intensive therapy. Children with high-risk disease get much more aggressive therapy. So we stratified by disease, risk, and then by phase of therapy, induction being the first 28 days of therapy when the goal is to rapidly bring down the leukemic burden. Consolidation is the most intensive phase of CNS treatment that lasts about 6 to 8 months. And then continuation. So you can imagine during this time period, the child's undergoing fairly aggressive therapy. So what did we find? This is our diagnostic LP, induction, consolidation, and continuation for low standard and high risk. And this is the oxidation of the phospholipid phosphatidylcholine. And we found significant group meaning low standard or high, and phase of therapy effects, documenting that children who had the greatest amount of methotrexate had the greatest amount of oxidation, and that was also highly correlated with methotrexate doses. And we found a similar thing. We were interested in two fatty acids, C16 and C18, which means there's 16 carbons and 18 carbons with one double bond. And these are the most prevalent in the central nervous system. And again, we have the same model, diagnosis, induction, consolidation, and continuation. And I particularly want to draw your eyes to C18 and notice the children who had the high-risk disease with the greatest amount of methotrexate had the greatest increase in oxidative stress. I didn't, for purposes of time, include the correlations, but I can assure you that the increase in oxidative stress was correlated with declines in cognitive abilities. So, our future. We want to test alternate methods for delivering our intervention. Despite all great efforts, we bumped up against a few things. First, if a child was sick and delayed in therapy, they wouldn't be able to come to clinic that day and they would miss their intervention session. Second, if a child lived a long distance from the treatment center, because we hooked our intervention onto when the child came to clinic for treatment. We had several children who lived on the reservation, and getting them to come weekly was quite a significant burden. So we are working on developing a computer-based model where we have found a company that can help us develop and test the intervention in a computer-based model that can be then delivered in the home. And we have already begun to look at long-term survivors of childhood leukemia. And let me tell you, this is a difficult population. Once you deal with a child who's already experienced a 10 to 15-point decline in their academic abilities, and you're trying to help them recover that, it's much more difficult, from my point of view, than prevention. We are also interested in looking at children who receive therapy for cancer in other types of diagnosis groups, such as brain tumors. And lastly, develop models to investigate strategies to inhibit oxidative injury. And I look forward to working with some of my colleagues, such as Carrie Merkel, to test ways to protect the brain from oxidative damage. I'd like to thank our research team. It's a two-site study, University of Arizona and Baylor College of Medicine, which is in Houston. I'd like to acknowledge Cynthia Anholt, who really was central to developing the intervention, and Petra Mekatova, who worked with me in the lab. The other people have been central to the study. I'd also like to acknowledge a dear friend, Marilyn Hockenberry, who is at Texas Children's, and without their help, we would not have been able to recruit all the children that we received from there. And I'd like to thank NINR for our current grant, a previous grant, and this grant was awarded to Dr. Kamik, but it did contribute to some of our long-term data. Assistance from our P20 and Oncology Nursing Foundation, which actually funded our preliminary work to give us the pilot data for this grant. Thank you. Did I make it on time?